This is the Photography Podcast on photography.ca, episode number 67, Orton Imagery, sometimes known as the Orton Effect or the Orton Technique, an interview with Michael Orton and Darwin Wiggett. Hey there, photo lovers. How's it going? And welcome to the 67th Photography Podcast on photography.ca. My name is Marco, and as always, we're coming to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. For today's show, we're going to talk about a creative technique called Orton Imagery, or sometimes known as the Orton Effect or the Orton Technique. And this is an amazing technique that's been around for over 20 years now, and it's a great way to give images a glow, a dripping with color effect, and it's super, super cool. The 20-second abridged version of the Orton technique, just in case people want to know what they're getting into before they listen, is having an image made of two pieces of slide film or two layers in Photoshop. One of the layers or the slides is a sharp version, one of the layers or the slides is a blurry version, and they're both overexposed. By combining them, you get this image that is just dripping with light. It's very ethereal and absolutely gorgeous. Before we get into it, though, I'd like to thank Ants for his comment on our last podcast, number 66, where we talked about ways to become a photography assistant. As always, people can leave comments and suggestions in many different areas on photography.ca, on the bulletin board. Anyone can email me, photography.ca@gmail.com. But the preferred way to leave comments is right through the blog, photography.ca/blog, right underneath the post where the podcast is located. If people want to leave comments, it's so appreciated, and it's our preferred method to get them. Today's podcast is a little bit longer than normal, so we're going to get right into it now. This podcast is all about Orton imagery, as I mentioned, and this is actually an interview with the creator of the technique, Michael Orton, and then we're going to follow up on the second part of the podcast with an interview with Darwin Wiggett. Both of these photographers generously share all kinds of tips and techniques on how to improve your Orton imagery. And their images are fantastic. No BS here. Links are going to go in the show notes. These are top-notch photographers and landscape photographers in particular. You have to look at these guys if you've never looked at their work before. All right, then, let's just get right into the first part of the interview with Michael Orton, and we're going to get into it now. So I'd like to welcome a very special guest to our podcast. Today we have Michael Orton, and he's the creator of a very popular effect that has changed over the years, but this podcast is dedicated to the Orton effect. So before we start the podcast, welcome, Michael. It's a pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Hi, Marco. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much. So let's just get right into it right away. A lot of people are using this Orton effect, and if there are a few people that don't know what it is, I'd rather have the inventor of the effect describe it rather than me. Could you just describe what that effect is for people that may not know what it is?
Well, Orton imagery, to make it really, really simple, is the placing of two images, one on top of the other. One image basically is devoid of color or very, very little color in it, but lots of detail, sharpness. And the other image is basically a color block that you sandwich on top of that. And this, of course, started out for me back in the era of slide film. And I started doing this in the late 80s, 84, 85, around there. And it originated not really from a photographic source at all, or from another form of photography, though photographers have been sandwiching slides forever and ever. This came to me because of my affiliation with some local artists here in town, and they were nice enough to let me tag along and watch what they were doing, and observe how they did it and how they treated colors and light and shapes and forms. And one of the popular techniques back then for these painters was to do something called pen and ink and watercolor. And what that meant was they would go out into the field and they would make a sketch of an image, whatever they were working on, primarily using pen and ink on white paper. So you had a picture, basically a drawing, that showed all the details, all the main components of a composition done in black and white. Then they would take that drawing and begin to watercolor in the areas between the pen and ink. Not like a color by numbers by any means, but that was basically what they started with. And I began to think about what I was doing with slide film at the time, and I thought, well, I could create the first one, the one with the washed out color and lots of detail, simply by overexposing. So I started overexposing slides 1, 2, 3, and 4 stops. And, of course, I got what I expected I would get, pictures that showed detail but no color. And then the next step, of course, was to begin to take the color component of that sandwich or combination by defocusing the same image. So it kind of evolved from that, really. The main thing to think about when you're doing this, whether you're doing it with slide film, which probably very few people are, or digitally, is to keep that in mind, that what you want to create, to put together, to combine, perhaps we should call them layers in your computer, is two separate layers. One that has all the detail in it and all of the lines of definition, and another one that is simply color blocks. You can tell from looking at the color blocks when you create that image what it is, but there really isn't a lot of detail there. It can be, and that, of course, that degree of softness or defocusing can vary considerably. And I suppose that's the beauty of having a computer. You can watch it as you're doing it. With slide film, back in those days, of course, I had to bracket considerably, and I would go with various amounts of defocusing and overexposure, and then I would have to basically look at them on the light table afterwards. And I commonly would, if I found something that I was really excited with, it would be common for me to shoot an exposure roll of film just on that one object or composition, so that I had plenty of options once I got to the light table. And if you think about that in the back of your mind when you're doing this, let's not call it a technique, let's call it an impression or a style, is to create those two basic components, one with detail and no color, or very, very little color, and one with the color in it, but very little detail. And the combination of the two of those is what gives you the final effect. Does that sort of simplify it, Marco?
Yeah, totally, absolutely simplifies it. Just to make it crystal clear, so what you did, and please correct me if I'm wrong, what you did back in the late 80s, let's say, or mid-80s, let's say, is you would actually take two separate exposures on slide film, the way you just described now, overexposed, one sharp, one not sharp, and you would actually you would sandwich them, which for people that may not know what sandwiching is, that's actually putting one piece of slide film on another piece of slide film in a slide mount, and then you have your final effect. Is that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I used a jeweler's loop, something very very precise, in order to look at the two images together. I pop all of them out of their slide holders to start with, so I'm dealing with just raw film on the light table.
Yeah.
And then I would begin to try my different combinations to find the ones that I was most pleased with. And when I found those, it took a little bit of dexterity, actually, and it's something that I guess I developed over a period of time, but holding that film in my fingers and then locking it with a tiny, tiny little piece of scotch invisible tape. Now, this piece of tape is like a quarter of an inch by a quarter of an inch, so this is quite a tiny little piece of tape that I would lock it on the edges with. And once it was locked on two edges with that piece of tape, I could then insert it back into the slide holder and either glue or, in some cases, use a soldering iron and heat fix the plastic again so that it would remain in the holder. And then, because some of the images you needed to slide just at slightly, such a tiny amount to get exactly the right indexing of areas in it. So it was a kind of I don't know how you'd describe that. It was a kind of a little bit of a picky thing when you were looking at some of them. You could move them just a very slight amount, and they were obviously out of index. And then you could twist it a little bit and find that point where it looked correct.
Yeah.
And so, I developed a fair bit of eye strain probably doing that for days on end. If we would travel, I would have, I could commonly shoot 40 to 50 rolls of film. And so I had literally at times hundreds of these images to work through, you know. And I've had some long days bent over the light table trying this and trying that, it was very much a physical thing in those days, which the computer now, doing it digitally, which I don't, my wife does all of that, by the way, is quite a different thing, and she can index images much more precisely than I could have on the light table with using a loop, you know, to look at the film itself.
And there's also, I mean, there must be other advantages to doing it through the computer these days. One of them, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, might be subject matter. I mean, back when you were doing it with slide film, you weren't, actually, let me ask, were you able to do this with a person, or would the person move in between exposures so it was really, the effect was more suitable to things that didn't move, let's say like trees and things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, 99% of the time I was using this style for landscape photography, and absolutely, I'm on a tripod, and everything gets locked very tightly. Once I make the initial composition and decide on that, then the only thing that moves is the focusing ring and the zoom, and I think I mentioned this earlier when we were talking in conversation, that I was using a one-touch zoom for this technique, because when you're defocusing an image and you're looking through the viewfinder, of course it changes in size.
Yeah.
So what I had to do to compensate for that was to, as I'm defocusing, I had to zoom a very slight amount so that even though the picture was being defocused, it remained the same size in the viewfinder, because that image was going to have to sandwich with ones I'd taken earlier that were in focus.
Right. And again, I'm just curious here. Did you ever try this with a human subject or never?
I didn't try it with human beings. I did try it with a couple of horses once. And of course, I saw the picture, and I'm back in my mind, I'm thinking, please stay there, please stay there.
Yeah, exactly.
A horse is a funny creature. When it sees you looking over the fence, it wants to walk towards you. And not that that's a bad thing, but I did manage to complete a couple of sequences with horses in them, and they fortunately stayed pretty well where they were. I took another one as well with a swan floating on water. Over time, I did get very, very proficient at going through these steps. I could do it in a matter of seconds. I could fire off the sharp images almost instantaneously, and then compensate 1.5, 2 stops, 2.5 stops over, and then go to the color component. And I could also, I was very, very accustomed to my cameras at the time. Like, they functioned in my hands. I didn't even know they were there at times. I could manipulate the controls, change film, and have a conversation with someone and be 100% right on. So being very, very conversant and at ease with my camera was very important in those situations, which I think is the case for most photographers. I don't think that if you're really going to put your mind into what you're seeing and what you're doing with it, you don't want to spend a lot of energy battling with your camera.
Yeah.
It should be a very, very...
fluid experience, I think.
Yes, exactly.
And I agree with you. And I guess I was just asking to know if there are still 10 people on the planet that want to try this technique with film, and with a slide film rather. And it's very, like, I love to see these things in slide film, though nobody's really doing it anymore, just because when you look at them, they're so rich with color.
Yeah.
And I mean, and you can simulate very, very closely and do things with a computer that you cannot do with slide film, but there is still something about doing it manually, old school, that at least appeals to me.
Yes.
So I guess my question was, if someone did want to try this with a person or a being that actually moves from breath to breath, the key to doing that successfully, what I'm getting from you is that you do it quickly, because in between the exposures, they're likely to have more time to move.
Yeah, I think it could be done. I don't see a reason why not, especially if the person is aware that you're taking their picture.
Right, of course.
Not a candid picture, but it's just, you know, a semi-studio or something set up under a tree outside. Absolutely. If they sit and remain somewhat where they are, I don't see a problem, because the out-of-focus image really doesn't have any detail in it, or should have very little detail in it. You could be able to tell that it's a person's face and that there's hair and that there's the shape of it, but you really don't see much detail in that component. As long as the sharp picture is the one that's taken with the detail in it is okay, there's no movement there, I don't see why it wouldn't work. It should work fine. Think of soft light, though. If you really want it to work well, think of soft light. Stay away from harsh contrast. Stay away from shadows, especially if you're shooting people, I would imagine. Although I'm not no one would call me a people photographer.
Right.
You know, it's just not my thing. But I know from this technique that if you're going to layer, then what's going to happen if there's a dark area anywhere in the picture, it will become darker.
Right.
And light areas in the picture will become lighter. So you're going to have a wider range of contrast, and that probably won't be attractive with a person as your subject matter.
Right. And even with landscapes, I've seen a lot of Orton imagery, and most of them don't have shadows that are too dark. They're mostly, or many of the ones that I've seen, they're bursting with light.
Yep.
And less shadow detail, more in the highlight and the color aspect.
Yep.
That's where the focus is, and that, for me, is, of course, part of the great appeal.
Yes. Yes. Using subdued light, soft, even light, for my eye, anyways, and you know, my eye is only my eye. It's not everyone else's. It's just mine. That was what I, after a period of time, that's basically where I went to or gravitated to, was looking for that type of imagery, was soft, subdued light, and I did a lot of photography on overcast days and even a considerable amount in the rain or the soft rain, and that gave a very, very wonderful effect to the images. Even if they weren't sandwiched, they were beautiful. But once you added that that combination of layers, it definitely added a glow or a different life to the image altogether.
Right, and which is the reason that people are practicing this technique or effect or way to do this type of imagery all over the world, because they love it too.
They're looking for that glow or that life or that different. There is a different feel to it. Some words sort of don't describe it exactly.
Ethereal comes to mind pretty
ethereal.
Quickly.
Yeah, that's a good one probably.
Thank you so much for that information, Michael. It's so appreciated and a real treat to speak with the originator of this technique or style or effect that we're talking about. Just so people know, I'm going to be putting more information in the second half of this podcast on how to do this technique with the computer in a digital domain. But I really wanted to get the history of the technique or effect. And thank you so much, Michael. It's so appreciated that you agreed to do this with us.
You're quite welcome, and I'm very happy that photographers out there are experimenting with this, and I would encourage them to experiment with many, many other things as well. That's basically what kept me in photography was for so many years was the
play.
Was that the play and the experimentation and trying things that I wasn't sure fit into the normal. But I know that if it's quite a neat feeling to go out and make something, be in a situation, and create an image that you really feel you had something to do with, that wasn't something that you had picked up somewhere else, but something that you yourself had originated. And so, and that's really a possibility for anyone that wants to do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for doing this, Michael, and have a great rest of the day, and please continue doing your photography. For people listening to this, I'm going to put some links to Michael's work in the show notes so you can see exactly this technique, and I'll put some links as well to where you can see many more of Michael's images. Thanks again for doing this, Michael, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you very much, Marco.
I'd like to thank Michael one last time for doing that great interview with us, and I absolutely appreciate getting the history of Orton imagery from the creator. Even though the technique started out with slide film, and not many people are likely to try that technique with slide film today, by talking with someone that spent years, you know, creating the effect and ameliorating the effect and experimenting the effect, tips and tricks like what kind of light to shoot it in, what kind of subject matter can be used, these are all invaluable tips. So thanks so much again, Michael. If you want to see some of Michael's work up close, I highly recommend the book of Photographing Creative Landscapes. I'm going to put a link into the show notes. And in that book, Michael discusses Orton imagery, as well as all kinds of other techniques to improve your landscape photography. Michael's images are not the easiest to find on the net, but I'm going to try and put one or two in the body of the post. And I'm going to put another couple of links where you could look at many more examples of his great photography. And it's really top-notch. You're going to be impressed. Guaranteed. For part two of this podcast, we're doing an interview with Darwin Wiggett, again, another fantastic photographer. And in this part, we're going to talk more about the digital application and how to make Ortons in the digital domain. And let's just get right into Darwin's part now. And so I'd like to welcome another special guest to this podcast. First guest, as you just heard, was Michael Orton. And this guest is Darwin Wiggett. And Darwin has a lot of experience with Ortons in the new digital domain. And Darwin's been gracious enough to share some of the techniques with us. So before we start, welcome, Darwin. Thanks for agreeing to do this.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's just get right into it, as always. Just in case some people don't know, Darwin has a fantastic collection of landscapes. Just beautiful. It's at darwinwiggett.com, DarwinWiggett.com. Link to go in the show notes. How did you start becoming interested in Ortons, Darwin?
Well, I believe I read a magazine. I think it was Pop Photo, and it might have been in the 80s. That's a long time ago, but I remember seeing this technique that Michael Orton had, and he had this spread in the magazine, and I was blown away by the photographs, because mostly here was a situation where somebody made images with a camera, but they looked like paintings, and that just floored me, because it was photographs became beyond documentary. They were expressionistic and moody and powerful, and I went, wow, I've got to try that. So I just read the technique and tried it out in the field and got results back, and all of a sudden I went from photographer to artist, and I said, wow, that's awesome. So it was one of those situations where you read something in a magazine, you try it, and it connects with your personal vision, and I guess from there the rest is history. I use the technique fairly often whenever I think I've got an image that already has some kind of evocative mood. If I want to enhance it, I will do an Orton.
The technique obviously started with slide film, and these days very few people are using slide film. Are you still using slide film, or you're doing all of this through the computer?
Right now, it's all through the computer.
I guess our listeners would love to know just a basic overview of the technique that you use. You've actually written quite a comprehensive piece, and the link will go in the show notes as well, and you've just let me know that you're thinking of redoing it with updated information, which is great. But just as a basic overview, if you could describe the technique to our listeners, it would be really great.
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons for the rewrite is not that the original mechanism to do it is inappropriate, but I think also because a lot of people are I wrote it for Photoshop and using layers in Photoshop, but a lot of people are using Elements or Lightroom or Capture NX and all sorts of different things, and so I thought maybe it'd be nice for people who are using different programs to write things, a tutorial for each kind of program, because there might be slightly different steps, but generally, the kind of overriding thing that a person needs to do is take your digital image. It's a finished image. You could have captured it in RAW or as a JPEG, and it's all completed the way you like it. And then, really, what you got to do is just make a copy of that image, because you don't, of course, want to work on your original image. And then, essentially, what you're going to do is just like what we used to do with slide film, is you're just going to make two images. One is going to be overexposed, but they're both going to be overexposed, but one's going to be overexposed and sharp, and the other's going to be overexposed and blurry, and then you're just going to, most programs, turn these two images into layers and then blend them together using different blending modes. So essentially what you're doing is the same as with slide film. You're taking two images, stacking them together in the same mount, so to speak, the same digital mount, and they're overexposed, and when you put two overexposed things together, you can make a properly exposed image, one that contains the sharp elements and the other that's the blurry kind of dreamy elements. And really, like anything with software, there's 95 ways to skin a cat, and so there's all sorts of different ways that people do it. But really, in the end, what you need to do is just have a program that's able to blend two pictures together, one on top of another, so that you can see the elements of both pictures together.
Great info. What would some of the advantages be of doing this through the computer as opposed to doing it with slides?
Well, I think, you know, the main advantage is control, because with slide film, you know, you're taking your overexposed shots, and probably what Michael explained is, you know, the sharp one is less overexposed than the blurry one, but you could try all sorts of variations of slide film. Of course, you're going to blow a whole roll of 36 millimeter, take it into the lab. I remember used to doing this all the time. I'd have these overexposed images, and then I'd have sharp and blurry overexposed image, take them to the lab, and then the people at the lab would go, well, Darwin, you need to, we need to talk about metering. I'd say, no, I did that on purpose, right? But the whole thing is you'd throw a bunch of pictures on the light table, and you would mix and match and come up with things. The great thing about digital is you can just, you don't even have to shoot out in the field with an idea for Orton. You can just photograph stuff that you like and stuff that resonates with you. And then when you get back, you can look at something and go, yeah, you know, this is kind of soft and moody, and I can actually add more to that if I add Orton to it. So I will just take this image and try an Orton technique, see if it works. The nice thing with digital is you can add all sorts of different blur. You can add a little bit of blur. You can have a whole lot of blur on the blurry layer image. You can also reduce the opacity between the two, so you can have all sorts of nuances. You can change different kinds of blending modes. For instance, multiply or darken or soft light or all sorts of different blending modes. It gives you incredible amount of different looks. So the sky is kind of the limit, and you can sit there with your cup of coffee or your glass of wine, depending on the time of day, and just play until you get something that actually is what you've seen in your mind's eye. And that was a lot harder with film. It was way more of a guess, and then sometimes you got stuff serendipitously that was amazing, and a lot of times things kind of failed. But with the computer, you can just keep playing until you find something that works.
Quick question on a technical level. Because we're making one of the layers blurry, does it make sense to shoot the image as sharp as possible? How does that work in terms of deciding the original aperture of the image that you're going to use on the computer?
Right. Really, there's a couple things you can do. Mostly, I just shoot an image. Like in most of my landscapes, I quite often want a lot of depth of field. So I'm often shooting at f16 or f22 so that I have maximum depth of field. And I just go out and shoot images like that. And then when I come back into the computer, I'll have my sharp image, and then I'll make a duplicate and take the sharp image and make a lighter version, like quite a bit lighter. You can use curves or levels or all sorts of ways, brightness and contrast, even just to make the image look really bright, like in the film days, you'd probably call that 1 or 1.5 stops brighter than what it should be.
Yep.
And then I'll, you know, make a duplicate of that bright image, and then just use Gaussian blur. And often I'll just, depending on the resolution of the file that you're working with, a blur between 20 to 50 pixels seems to work well. So then I've got a blurry copy, a bright blurry copy, and a bright sharp copy. And then in Photoshop, I'll just drag one layer on top of the other, make sure they're in alignment, and then just change the blending mode. You can try darken's really interesting. Multiply is the one that we'd normally use when you have two light images together. You just use multiply blending mode, and then you've got a really nice image. So I guess the answer to your question is, in the field, I just shoot like I normally would and try to get the sharpest image possible, because I can blur it as much as I want in software. Some people actually do what they would normally do with slide film in the field with digital cameras. They actually go out and on purpose shoot a sharp image, and then they shoot a blurry one for an Orton, and then in the computer they'll overexpose them a bit and then blend them together. Some people actually shoot in the field a digital blurry copy, because you get a different out-of-focus kind of effect with a lens than you do with any kind of software blur. So some people prefer that.
from my understanding, it may not make sense to shoot the first image blurry if you're only going to use one image. So a lot of people may not want to use more than one image. They only want one image, then they'll make that duplicate layer. But if that duplicate layer is a copy of, you know, something shot at f2.8 or f4, mm-hmm. there's no way to really get that sharp part of the image, is there?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So
that's the beauty of the technique, because what happens is you've got sharpness surrounded by a glow of color. That's why the Orton technique is so evocative, is because there's like sharpness there, so you can identify the object, but there's this beautiful glow. And the more blurry you make the image, either with the lens, making it more out of focus, or with the software, the bigger that kind of glow, the bigger the radiation of the glow of colors is. And so you need that sharpness to contrast with the glow. And if it's just a big glow, it's just a blurry picture. It's kind of like when you use a long shutter speed effect when you're photographing waterfalls, for instance. If you just photograph the water, and then all you get is this blur of water with nothing to contrast it with to show you that it's actually water. But if you have a rock in there or a twig or part of the bank, and then you see this, you know, misty water contrasted with a sharp rock or sharp vegetation, then you can kind of put it more in context. And it's with the Orton technique is you need that sharpness to contrast with the blur to really make it work.
It makes total sense, but I just wanted it to be crystal clear, and now it is. From speaking with Michael as well, from the first part of the interview, he was also suggesting that for him it always worked better in subdued light, low contrast light, overcast skies. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, exactly. Often the best Orton pictures for me have been kind of what I call intimate landscapes or intimate details, where they're, you know, it's a section of forest scene or grasses, or, you know, really works well with vegetation. And overcast light, yeah, overcast or in the shade. Now, you know, like every kind of rule in photography, there's times to break it. And I've actually seen people, and myself included, create some images that are shot in the sun, and they're, I guess, what you might call, you know, wide-angle landscapes that actually work. Often, though, with the Orton technique, anywhere where there's shadows, and this is where the contrasty light problem comes in, dark shadows will turn super black. And so it's okay if those black shadows work with the composition in you know, the different kind of terms of light and dark and then light and dark balance, but often super dark shadows, I mean, just yank your eye and take away that whole soft ethereal look, because it's hard to be soft and ethereal when you're rich, black, dark kind of shadows. But I've seen some Orton images that kind of work with that to give more of a moody kind of dark ages, really gothic kind of look. So, like everything, it depends, but in general, I've had most success, as has Michael, with overcast images or images shot in shade.
Right, and that's a pretty good tip, actually. I mean, we use this expression over and over. You got to know the rules before you can break the rules. You can always break the rules, but it's good to know, you know, the right or conventional way to do it, or the original way that the creator did it, and then, you know, play. And if you get great results with your subject matter, yahoo.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if people using Photoshop know how to make actions, then what I do is I've made an Orton action that then I can just take an image and, you know, click on the play button and it just does its thing, and I go, yep, it worked, it didn't work, and then you know right away. And, you know, I can make those actions available to readers if they want, and then they can if they have Photoshop, then they can just download the action. I can probably put it on my website if you want, or give you a copy, and they can download the action, and bang, then they can see if it works or not. And that way you're more free to experiment with things that may or may not work, but at least give it a try. I mean, some things I'm surprised that they work. There's a lot of things that I can predict, yeah, this is going to work great. It's going to be an Orton, and I do it. And there's other ones that I wouldn't even think of trying, but occasionally, just for fun, I play the action, and, oh, that's a surprise. That one really worked. So I think it's nice if... It's better if people understand the actual step-by-step technique of doing Ortons rather than just relying on an action. But if... you do understand that, and then you can save yourself time by running an action, then you can just kind of quickly see if something's working or not.
Great, that's great. And, you know, I can speak freely here. I'm sure our listeners would love to experiment with the action you've created. We've actually done a podcast in the past on actions, and one of the nice things about them is that they can also be modified to your own taste, right? You could take one step in the action, and if it was too severe or not severe enough, you can modify that to your own taste.
Exactly. Like, for instance, the blur part, you can have the action stop there, and then you can say, oh, look, I want only 20% or 20 pixel blur, I want 100 pixel or whatever. There's certain steps where you, as a user, can say, I want to input this, and then continue on and see how it works. So you're right. That's the beauty of the action is you can supply some input so that it's just not an automated thing. I'm probably like yourself, against pure automation, because then what's the point of creativity and artistic input if everything's just an automated kind of button? So I agree with you. It's really great that people can add their own flavor to it.
Cool. And then we're not going to keep you too much longer, but you're obviously your shooting subjects are usually landscapes. Have you tried Orton's on anything unusual, on people, on pets, on anything out of the ordinary that might be intriguing?
Yeah, well, on people, and actually on pets, it works great. When I first started Orton, I tried it on everything because, you know, it's a new technique. It's kind of like when you buy a new lens, you know, or buy some kind of new piece of gear. You just go crazy with it until you find out what its limitations are and what it does well. And I did that with Orton. And you know, I use Orton on people a lot when I was doing a lot of people, and especially on kids. And I do still do a lot of dog photography and pet photography. And I use Orton on there, but I don't. The problem is with, like, people and pets, if you do a complete Orton, then the eyes and teeth and stuff kind of get all weird. So I'll use a layer mask and I'll make the Orton and then put the Orton version on back onto the original image. I'll use a layer mask and paint back the eyes and the teeth and often the nose, so because it kills the glint and it makes the eyes look all weird. So then you can kind of have the original important part of the human face or the animal's face come through, but have that soft kind of glowy look in the fur or in the skin. So it works really well. And a lot of times just using like 50% opacity of the finished Orton on top of the original picture will give it a little bit of a dreamy look, will make it look slightly artistic but not over the top unreal. So yeah, I use Orton a lot with other subjects.
Good to know. It's just because so many, the vast majority of everything we see that's Orton-related is landscapes. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to, again, break the rules a little bit and just experiment and play.
Yeah, and it does wonderful things to skin. I mean, it's a fast way to kill skin blemishes and hot spots and stuff like that. I mean, there's, you know, all sorts of great retouching tools now, but one of the fastest ways to make skin look soft and dreamy is with Orton, and just, you know, blend back the Orton onto the skin and leave the rest of the picture alone. So, yeah, I say give it a try. It's awesome.
Cool. So thank you so much for that great information, Darwin. Again, links are going to go into the show notes for your website and books that you've written, and you've written loads of them, and they're beautiful. And I encourage especially landscape photographers to take a look at Darwin's work. Thank you so much for doing this, Darwin. It's greatly appreciated, and maybe we can speak to you again in the future.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Darwin.
And thanks again to Darwin Wiggett as well for sharing those great digital tips with us on how to create Orton in the digital domain. Darwin has actually written quite a number of books, including How to Photograph the Canadian Rockies in 2005, and he just released a new one called Dances with Light in 2009. Links will go in the show notes, and if you're at all interested in landscape photography, after you check out his own personal site, you may just want to buy the book, because it really is top shelf stuff. In terms of a step-by-step for how to create Orton imagery, well, Darwin Wiggett was nice enough to create a guide a few years back, and that guide was located on the Nature Photographers online magazine.
and they have graciously allowed us to reproduce the article on the photography.ca blog, so a special thanks to the group at naturephotographers.net for allowing us to reproduce this. Link again to go in the show notes, but the actual step-by-step will be written in the body of the blog post. A number of members in the photography.ca forum have already been playing with Orton imagery or the Orton effect for a while now, and Dwayne Oakes, one of our bulletin board members on photography.ca, and he produces great stuff as well, and he shared his technique that he uses with the program NX2, and I'm going to put that in the show notes as well. Speaking of our forum, it's always a nice place to see very interesting imagery on a large variety of subjects. We have an assignment each month, and June's assignment is shooting from a low angle. So if you haven't joined our forum yet and you're just lurking, I encourage you to join and maybe partake in one of the assignments. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Just get out there. There's so many things to photograph now, and especially armed with a new technique or something to try, just get out there and keep on shooting. Bye for now, everyone.